y'all, and welcome to Snacks for the Brain, episode number 58. I'm Scott Merrick, and I hope your summer's going as well as mine is. Episode number 58 is a departure from my usual format of interviews with research scientists, and there is a precedent for this departure. Both last year and the year before, I did report out to you in a Snacks for the Brain episode centered around NEC, the National Educational Computing Conference, held by ISTE, the International Society for Technology and Education, an organization of some, 38,000 members from all over the world. This year, NEC convened in Atlanta, Georgia, held at the huge Georgia World Conference Center. It ran officially from June 24th through 27th, but I was down there for the pre-unconference, EduBlogger Con Day, the 23rd, a chance to network with other bloggers and podcasters, and a half-day seminar the 24th on grant writing, and a full-day mini-conference on the 28th called the Online Learning Institute. I came back pretty much square-eyed, as you can imagine, and it's taken me this long to begin to sort out the amazing wealth of information to which I was exposed during that
long
week. The overwhelmingly overriding theme I carried away from the week is that NEC this year, because of new and emerging Web 2.0, or 3.0 in some folks' view, technology, this conference is one that will never end.
It is a conference that never ends, and it goes on and on, my friend. Some people started convening it, not knowing what it was, and they'll continue convening it forever just because it is.
You get my point. And it's the first one that was attended by people who weren't physically there. Maybe that happened in isolated pockets, but it was happening all over the place this year. David Warlick talked about people holding up their MacBooks during his packed presentation at NEC so that the room looked like, to him, like a rock concert with people waving their Bic lighters in the air. And suddenly he came to the realization that they were allowing friends and colleagues in remote locations to listen to his talk via Skype or some other voice over IP technology. There were 30 or 40 avatars in Second Life dancing and chatting at the simulated Georgia State Aquarium, while thousands of their colleagues in Atlanta enjoyed the Sunday night reception at the real aquarium. I myself co-moderated a Birds of a Feather session in and about Second Life with my co-moderator, Jeremy Coaster, physically located in San Antonio, Texas, and both of us at ISTE Island in Second Life in avatar form. If you don't understand any of this, just go to secondlife.com and check that out. At any rate, many of these remotely participating commented that they felt connected, though they couldn't really attend in person for whatever reasons. And they reported that they were tracking blogs and podcasts from the conference to gain new knowledge, though they couldn't be physically present in Atlanta. Here's the point. All those resources are still available. The learning doesn't have to stop, in fact, and won't until the last teacher has clicked to play the last recorded archive session or read the last blog commentary detailing the last content a blogger was experiencing and learning about at NEC 2007. This is a little staggering, but it's clear to me that the only limiting factor now is the T word, time.
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 As we are charged with helping our students to manage their own work and time in healthy ways, we need to concentrate on learning that ourselves, mastering it ourselves. I myself struggle with the balance between teaching, learning, blogging, podcasting, exploring, playing, and maintaining a healthy family life alongside a manageable professional one. As a self-confessed non-linear learner, I am more and more aware of this challenge, and so I rise to meet it as I can.
All the worries in my head,
God, I was king, walking on tapering, getting tall and behaved, getting short and afraid, on and on. But it hurts too much to try and come and take cover underground over me. Still I'm far too scared to own it. Combat and cover, I'll be safe at you. All the poisons in this life, all the flowers in my hand, still I focus on demand in my way. Gaining entries in my world, sleeping on the windowsill. Supposed to build my new world. Heaven knows I used to want it. Showcase and flaunt it. Out of sight, out of mind. Then I can't slow down to try it. Walking in circles, out of fresh.
PodSafe Music Network. Go give him a listen at music.podshow.com. All right. Okay, well, let's get to the share. The first audio I'd like to share with you is from video I took during Peggy Sheehy's remarkable overview of her work in Second Life with her students. Her students are at the Suffern School in Suffern, it's S-U-F-F-E-R-N, New York, and in the Teen Grid in the virtual world Second Life. Peggy talked about her developing curriculum and began by discussing a tool developed by Deka Ma, that's her in-world name, and that tool consists of chairs arranged in pods that can be gathered together in a virtual room, like a classroom, for instruction, and then once the instruction's all set up, those pods are flung into the sky for small group discussions, a little more fun perhaps than trying to retreat to a corner of the room. Those discussions take place on keyboards, and they're text chats. If you listen up, you'll probably understand the benefits of this.
And the way this is used is for any kind of a discussion or reflection, the students hop in these pods, the teacher facilitates with any whole class instruction, and then the leader of the pod clicks the button and the pods go off into the sky so that they're at least 15 meters away from any other pods, and the chat is just then the five people.
Wow.
And those chats get emailed to the teacher. It's a great building tool. Now, we used it for a number of things, but one of the most powerful things we used it for was literature.
I was involved in literature and some project.
Okay, tell me a little bit about that.
The literature project was when my class went into pods and we discussed our literature circle book on Sunday. Every day we would go to the calendar and pick up daily questions and goals. And then we'd enter our pods and we'd fly up and have a conversation about the book, which was really interesting because we were a lot less intimidated.
Okay, now this was a unit that the health teacher conducted on body image. Middle school. And she came to me and she said, I think I have an idea about doing this in 7 months. So I'm going to real quick tell you what we did. We brought the kids in and we said, okay, today you're just going to make your avatar look as much like you really look in real life as you can. We had all sorts of stuff available for them, skins and shapes and hair and clothing and that. So that's what they did. And then they jumped in the pods and they went up and they reflected and responded to each other. The next day we gave them the same time and only we showed them the Dove Real Beauty campaign video where they show you how a relatively ordinary person gets the makeup and the hair and then it gets put into Photoshop and the neck gets longer and the cheekbones are raised and that's how you end up on a billboard and that these are not real women. So we said, today, create your avatar to be as beautiful as it can be according to the way the media portrays beauty. So what they did, getting all glamorous, and the guys were getting all buffed, and it was interesting. They went up in the pods, and they had the discussions. The third day, we did the same thing. We want a beautiful avatar today, but you're going to cross-gender. So guys, you're going to make yourselves into a beautiful woman, and girls, you're going to make yourself into a beautiful man. Same thing, up, discussion. The final avatar was a real-life avatar again, the way you choose to look. However you want to look down, you do it. Let me tell you about some of the discussions that went on in the fire. We expected to hear a little bit of griping about being down on the way the media portrays you, and it's just not realistic, and that's why the kids were talking about this. That's why they're all anorexic, and that's why they're all bulimic, and that's why everybody feels inferior, and everybody tries to buy the right clothes or look a certain way. And then they took it to another level where the teacher and I just stepped back and said, the discussion went something like this. Well, in Second Life, if anyone can be beautiful, then do we need to redefine beauty? Should maybe beauty be something more like individuality or a reflection of what you think, what you feel, who you really are? I mean, this discussion became nothing short of profound. And when you're dealing with middle school students who are so prone to peer pressure, who are putting new personalities on every day to find one that fits, we just thought this was terribly, terribly important.
My own presentation is shared at the Apple Distinguished Educators website and through iTunes. Search NECC Conference Connections at iTunes, and there will be a link at the Snacks show notes site to that one too, about Windows podcasting. It was attended by, surprise me, somewhere in the neighborhood of 240 educators. But Kathy Schrock's Web 2.0 presentation was attended by more than 1,000. Kathy shared a wealth of resources for teachers and administrators struggling to make sense out of the flourishing new technologies that fall into the 2.0 category, blogs, wikis, podcasts, and other collaborative tools. Listen to a little bit about what Kathy has to say about learning in the present tense and in the future. By way of a really, really good side-by-side comparison of Web 1.0 tools and Web 2.0 tools. Kathy?
Web 1.0 is the web we have known and loved, I have known and loved, since 1993. It's made up of static web pages the user visits to get information, search engines that the user utilizes to find information, and the random surfing on the information superhighway in hopes for some serendipitous discovery. Web 2.0, in its simplest sense, has a few separate parts. Web 2.0 applications are web-only applications. The information may be served automatically to the user by the use of new technologies, which we'll talk about later, such as RSS. And the user has the ability to interact with and add to and change online information. Let's look at a comparison between some Web 1.0 applications and some 2.0 applications. Remember that the original Netscape, and Netscape still, is a software application that runs on your computer, with different versions for different computer platforms. It was intended to provide a one-stop experience to the web. Google, on the other hand, has only ever been a web-based application, works on all platforms of computers, and is only the middleman through complex indices of information between the user and the information. Although Hotmail is a web-based application, it used to be the user had to go visit, log into Hotmail to find out if their information was available. Yahoo Mail was one of the first web mail applications that actually told you when you had email through an aggregation process. OPhoto, which I still call it because that's the way you learned it, but it's now Kodak Gallery, allows you to move pictures from your computer to the gallery. Flickr, on the other hand, allows you to move the pictures from your computer to the web, but also aggregate it. So when you put up the new picture of the grandchild, the grandparent can automatically be notified that that's happening. Personal websites are created in HTML, mounted statically on the web. Blogger pages are created most of the time using the blogger server and can be updated via cell phone and even telephone. MapQuest, we all know MapQuest with the incorrect information sometimes. That road isn't there. As you're driving, you blew it up with the 24-point type and you still can't find it. Provides a series of directions for the user. Google Maps, on the other hand, both allows the user to see where they are in relation to the world, as well as allows the ability to add content the user is interested in. This is one that I was interested in. Okay, this is a mashup, two or more applications combined to create a new information. So here's all the Starbucks within a few block area. Those of us that live about 42 miles from Starbucks, this is important. Yes, there are still places that don't even have a Walmart. Well, you know, just sometimes. Okay. From the mid-1980s, when the first graphical access to the web showed up, we have become comfortable with Web 1.0. However, most people read the net instead of producing for it because production required you to have these things: HTML coding skills, programming skills, some semblance of a graphic design skill, a place to put it, and a way to get your information out about your site so people would actually come visit it. Web 2.0 came about in the late 1990s as a result of a new class of online software that simplified content creation and allowed the user to focus on ideas, creativity, and collaboration rather than the technical know-how, and the ideas live on the web and can be and usually are publicly accessible. What really separates Web 1.0 from 2.0 is the fact that it's possible to combine things from various sources and create something new. For example, an idea for a Web 2.0 site might be to combine a Flickr tag gallery of restaurants with actual reviews that people have put up and a connection to Google Maps to find the restaurants in your area. But you don't own any of that content, but you combine it together so someone comes to your page and gets all that information. My son just went storm chasing a couple of weeks ago, and he wrote a program that he had the laptop hooked up to the cell phone in the car. He had a little GPS, and he wrote a program so I can log on to his blog and see Google Maps, see the severe weather that he was driving into, and a little webcam on the dash, and also how fast he was going. So at one point I called him and said, "You're going 76.8 miles in Connecticut. I know that's not right." It can be dangerous.
Snacks for the Brain is brought to you by the fine folks at the Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach, connecting working research scientists with K-12 students worldwide. Check out the website at scienceoutreach.org.
Thanks for listening, y'all. The clock's getting the better of us for this show, so I'll leave you with a short clip from the Online Learning Institute's keynote talk by educational technology frontline soldier Chris Deedy. Chris holds the Wirth Technology Chair at Harvard Graduate School of Education and gave a fantastic talk about how schools need to change in response to the way work is changing and in response to the way students are learning. It's a very brief clip, but if you want to learn more, take a look at my own blog at scottmerrick.net. Also, keep an eye out for the archives from the Online Learning Institute at www.ecb.org. That's the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board. All righty, Chris Deedy, leave us with something to think about. Leave us with a question.
Thinking is now distributed. Now that sounds a little odd, because of course when I'm thinking, I am thinking inside of my own brain. But I and other people now also think in partnership with tools, in partnership with others, and across distance and time. So a couple months ago, I did my income taxes. That's always a discouraging experience for me. But I was working with an intellectual partner, an income tax program. It does what it does well, which is to add and multiply numbers correctly and put them on the right line of the form. I do what I do well, which is to make up creative excuses for the IRS. And the two of us work very well together. I and you, when we teach, use asynchronous discussions. So we have a group of people who are thinking together, but they're not thinking at the same time, and they're not thinking at the same place. They're thinking, their work is dispersed physically, socially, and symbolically. That is a big shift. And when do we say that that's online? And when do we say that it's not?
Snacks for the brain, good for me. Snacks for the brain, help me see. Pieces on the puzzle that I didn't see before. Keep them in my eye.